Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not just the Trump administration versus Harvard. More than a million international students study in the U.S.
Now they all are under this cloud of uncertainty.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Also today, Russia and Ukraine are carrying out their largest prisoner swap yet, but there's very little progress on peace talks.
We're not going to see the Ukrainians agree to any deal that doesn't leave them sovereign and secure in what's left of Ukraine.
And setting up an elaborate simulation of a horrific car crash to figure out what can be learned.
I didn't think I'd feel like this. It's not real. What it could have been.
We'll also hear about the legacy of a towering figure in Russian ballet and the village in Spain that didn't go dark when the rest of the country did. That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us today. Less than a week before graduation, thousands of international students at Harvard University got some good news. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's attempt to revoke Harvard's ability to enroll students from abroad.
The Department of Homeland Security is accusing the university of failing to provide disciplinary records. But Harvard says the move to block international students from enrolling is unlawful and retaliatory. Carl Tobias, who teaches law at the University of Richmond, says the Ivy League university has a strong legal case.
It looks pretty obvious that the administration's just targeted the university. This eviscerates the international aspect of what Harvard does so well, bringing in the best people from the world.
For more on the implications of all this, I spoke with GBH higher education reporter Kirk Carapeza.
DHS wants Harvard to hand over 5 years' worth of protest-related audio and video footage. The administration says the university has botched claims of anti-Semitism on campus, and it has accused the institution of collaborating with the Chinese Communist Party. Now, to regain its right to enroll international students, DHS says Harvard must submit all requested materials within 72 hours. The government also told students to transfer out or they're going to lose their visa status. And that could be devastating for Harvard because those students are a major funding source for the university.
So Harvard filed a lawsuit against the government. A judge today temporarily blocked DHS's ability to revoke international student enrollment there. What is Harvard saying?
So Harvard's challenging the government. They say this is unlawful and retaliatory. In a message to the campus community this morning, President Alan Garber condemned the action. He said it imperils the futures of thousands of students across Harvard and serves as a warning to countless others at schools across the country who've come here to pursue their education and fulfill their dreams. Garber said Harvard is going to do everything in its power to support their students. Harvard already has this pending lawsuit against the administration that challenges the freezing of billions of dollars in federal research funds, and it's accused the administration of retaliatory government overreach.
Kirk, I know you've been talking to international students on campus. How are they reacting? It must be very chaotic.
They're really worried, and they're afraid to talk to reporters on tape. On background, I can tell you they're freaking out. I spoke with Allison Frank Johnson. She teaches German history, and she advises many young international students who, over the past few months, she told me they've been showing up in her office, sometimes in tears. Mm. She says this latest action threatens Harvard's academic research and academic mission.
We're talking here about students who've worked their whole lives to be able to attend a college of this caliber, who've invested their family's time and money into the institution, and now they don't know if they can continue their educations.
And we should say this would also affect graduate students who are working in labs to cure cancer and other diseases. Some students are, you know, working on their dissertations and they just need a few more months to complete it. These students are a critical part of the university community, and many of them had nothing to do with the Gaza-related protests. But the students who were involved in the protests are the most afraid. They've seen videos, you know, recently of students being swept up and sent off to Louisiana to ICE detention centers, and they describe a real chilling effect. They're worried about being targeted online. They don't even want us to use their first names. They won't let us record. But the other students who have nothing to do with the protests, they feel like they've just been swept up in this and that they feel like they're pawns in this game between this political fight between Donald Trump and the country's oldest and wealthiest university.
How many students are we talking here? How many might be impacted?
Yeah, Harvard enrolls nearly 7,000 international students. That's about a quarter of the university's entire student body. And, you know, Harvard's in a better financial position to deal with all of this than other universities. I spoke with Geraldo Blanco. He directs the Center for International Higher Education at Boston College. And he says the chilling effect here is going to go far beyond Harvard.
The top universities in the United States that have been huge magnets for international students, now they all are under this cloud of uncertainty that their ability to enroll international students could be revoked just by a signature.
And Blanco, he says these attacks on Harvard and other selective schools could have long-term effects on higher ed.
So international students often pay more of the bill of their college educations than domestic students.
So, and they subsidize domestic students.
So this would have a financial impact on universities in the U.S. I'm wondering what other potential impacts you're hearing about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they bring, you know, tuition dollars, but they also bring, you know, their ideas, their cultures to campus. Professors on campus think this is really about, you know, just trying to not necessarily correct certain things that might be wrong at Harvard, and we can debate that, but it's an attempt to silence dissent and that this could all just scare those students away. I spoke with Ryan Enos. He teaches government at Harvard, and he says the decision here is anti-American and authoritarian.
What we're seeing here is the Trump administration trying to punish a university because it doesn't like its politics.
And he says hurting Harvard will also hurt the American people because it could lead to a brain drain.
If I were an international student, I would not want to come to an authoritarian country where without the rule of law, I could have my legal status suddenly removed.
Kirk, I wonder if you've been talking with anyone who, you know, does see value in the administration's approach against Harvard here.
Yeah, I think this is important to listen to these voices sometimes. I spoke with Jay Green. He's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And he says the idea that we'll see a global brain drain assumes that the only place for talented international students to go other than Harvard is outside the U.S.
Turns out it's a big country, and we have a lot of very excellent universities in the United States that are not engaged in systematic violations of civil rights like Harvard has been.
Of course, Harvard and other higher education leaders dispute that claim, but Green says federal research funding and now international student dollars could go to those other institutions instead. Others in higher ed see this as an opportunity for places like China to move in here and become the next magnet for global talent, and they fear that the Trump administration is just handing this to them.
Kirk Carapeza covers higher education at GBH in Boston and co-hosts the podcast College Uncovered. Kirk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been 5 years since George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis. Graphic video of Floyd's murder sparked protests against racism and police brutality around the world. In Britain, statues of former slave owners were torn down. In Australia, there were demands for justice for Indigenous people who've died in police custody. Half a decade on, though, just how much has changed? The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
It's easy to forget just how quickly George Floyd's death reverberated around the world. Within 24 hours, protests kicked off in Minneapolis where Floyd was killed.
Take your knee off our necks!
Take your knee off our necks!
And in a couple of days, they spread across the US, Canada, and over the Atlantic. It was May 2020, and Britain was under lockdown. But hundreds of thousands of people defied those COVID restrictions to march in London, including celebrities like Star Wars actor John Boyega.
Black lives have always mattered. We have always been important. We have always succeeded, regardless. And now is the time. I ain't waiting. I ain't waiting.
And for some, there was a sense that things were at a tipping point.
The magnitude of these mobilisations, I think, did give me hope that maybe this was a moment where some of the change that many of us in anti-racist communities have been demanding for a long time might actually be realised.
Remy Joseph Salisbury specialises in the study of racism, particularly in policing, at the University of Manchester. Black people are four times more likely to be stopped and searched in the UK than white people. That's according to the UK government's own data. In some cities, statues of historical figures associated with slavery or colonialism were torn down. In Bristol, a statue of slave trader Edward Colston was ripped off its pedestal and rolled through the city streets. In Canada, Sandy Hudson organised some of the biggest protests in Toronto.
It felt as though some sort of Rubicon was being crossed, in that people for the first time in a mass way were talking about the problems with policing, the problems with safety, and connecting it to anti-Black racism and disability and mental health.
And in some small ways, Hudson, who's co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement in Canada, says change did happen. Some Canadian cities, for example, introduced new mental health emergency phone lines, so the police are no longer the first port of call.
If you are experiencing an emergency mental health crisis, what you need is somebody who is trained in addressing the needs of someone who is going through a mental health crisis, and you don't want police to show up.
In many countries, protesters marched in memory of their own citizens who had died at the hands of the police. I can't breathe, I can't breathe, Assa Traoré chanted at a protest in Paris. Her brother Adama died in police custody at the age of 24 in 2016. Those were his last words too, she said. No one has been held accountable for his death. Nathalie Atoke, who was born in Paris, says 5 years on, there's little to show for what happened in 2020.
Honestly, I think, just like in the US, there is a fascist, racist backlash at the moment, and it's not specific to France. The far right is on the rise. You know, even the so-called moderate politicians are leaning towards racist and Islamophobic politics.
Atoke, who now lives in the US, is a professor of Francophone and Africana studies at the City University of New York. Emmanuel Macron's government, she says, has shown no interest in addressing institutional racism that remains a problem in France.
Because the vocabulary right now is all about law and order and, you know, dealing with immigration and radical Islam.
It's the kind of language you hear from governments in so many countries right now, she says. In Manchester, Remy Joseph Salisbury recalls how in 2020, opposition lawmakers were calling loudly to end racial inequality. Now that many of them are in power,
there's been no major shift in stop and search, no major shift in violence, no major shift in terms of accountability. There are still families dealing with the horrendousness of losing loved ones to police violence.
British police declined my request for an interview and pointed me towards a police race action plan drawn up in 2022, which promises a zero tolerance of racism in policing. Joseph Salisbury says he's seen little evidence of that, but those 2020 protests did spark one noticeable shift. It mobilised many young people to begin grassroots movements of their own, he says. Professor Nathalie Atoke says despite everything, she tries to stay optimistic.
Because the people who came before me went through worse and they still fought for freedom. And I have to think about the next generation.
I can't afford to give people a legacy of despair and hopelessness, she says. We have to keep fighting. We just don't have a choice. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Bad news for Gen Xers and millennials in Denmark, where the retirement age just keeps creeping higher.
Right now, Danes can retire at 67. That's set to go up to 68 in 2030 and 69 in 2035 as life expectancies increase. But now the Danish parliament has just approved another increase. Starting in 2040, the official retirement age will be 70.
Lots of people who will be impacted by the changes are mad. There were protests for weeks leading up to the vote in Copenhagen.
You're with the world.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. It's a worst-case scenario for drivers, a multi-car pileup on a congested highway. But that's exactly what engineers created on purpose using the runway of a former military base in Scotland.
It's wide enough that we can create our slow lane, middle lane, and fast lane, plus a hard shoulder and a lane for oncoming traffic.
Yep, this runway has everything going for it if you're trying to cause a collision. Eight drivers were chosen to give it a go, and they weren't necessarily selected for their experience.
My name's Caitlin. I live in Liverpool, and I'm 19. I've been driving now for around 6 to 7 months.
This is all part of the setup for a new PBS documentary called Ultimate Crash Test. Tom Adams is the show's executive producer. And Tom, I want to start by confirming that no one was hurt in the making of this documentary, right?
No, absolutely not. It was a horrendous pileup, but absolutely nobody was hurt.
So we'll get to how you actually did it, but what inspired you to intentionally create a multi-car pileup? What was the goal here?
Well, it was looking at crash tests, lab-based crash tests, which they have made such a difference to car safety. And, you know, we absolutely need those. But they're so regimented and they are so formulaic. And what we wanted to do was sort of introduce that glorious messiness of the real world into a crash test to examine how external influences, people, conditions, ages of car, types of car, can all interact to create something akin to chaos, and what could be learned from that.
So how did you create this pileup without having actual drivers in the vehicles?
We essentially built huge remote control systems. So we had 8 cars driven by real drivers in what we called a remote pod, tiny 2-seater cars that we surrounded in screens and linked them to their real-life track car. So each driver was in their own pod. They had a steering wheel, accelerator, brake, etc. And when they hit the gas, their car on the track, be it an F-150 or a Golf hot hatch, that would move just as you would expect it to. They could steer, they could brake, they could overtake, and then we let them go. However, unbeknownst to them, they had something coming the other way that they were going to have to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, this was a rather sobering documentary to watch. I mean, describe what happened when the drivers hit the quote-unquote road. Because it wasn't just drivers on a dangerous road. As you said, something else happened there. What happened?
Well, we had to make sure there was a crash. We had to create something that they had to avoid. And then we would see how they crashed or if they avoided the crash, because that was perfectly possible as well. So we stacked the odds in our favor, essentially, with two things. We had a truck coming down the other side of the freeway, the other lane. And at the last moment, that simulated a tire blow and it swerved across the oncoming traffic, the lanes that our drivers were in. They were approaching that truck at 70, 80 miles an hour. We also put a layer of gravel onto the track just before our envisaged impact point. That was to simulate something that is often seen in multi-vehicle pileups. And that is either poor road surface through ice or, you know, excess water, and poor visibility. So very often that's fog. And so what this light layer of gravel did was reduce friction on the road surface while kicking up a bit of dust. So all of a sudden they had gone from perfect road conditions to something akin to a foggy, icy stretch of road, which does happen time and time again in pile-up incidents.
And this truck was just not any truck. It was a giant 18-wheeler.
Yes, it was a big 18-wheeler that, as I say, was coming the other way, swerved across three lanes of traffic and the shoulder. And essentially, it was down to our drivers to manage that as best they could. We watched the outcome. We saw how drivers reacted. We saw how cars reacted. And what we were looking for was whether drivers behaved in different ways or whether cars managed multiple impacts well or less well. Because what you're often seeing in lab-based tests are single impacts. So they will hit a wall at a certain speed, or they will get T-boned at a certain speed, whatever it might be. What we were doing was seeing how cars react when they hit something, then they may bounce onto something else, then they're shunted from behind, and then they're dragged into something else. So how do vehicles hold up when they are under those kind of conditions?
And as a viewer, you see this whole thing from every angle. Cameras are all over the place. You see each vehicle, you see the truck, you see how it all happens. It's pretty amazing. I wonder what you found out in terms of how drivers reacted.
You mentioned all that data collection, which was a vital part of the experiment. This wasn't just a stunt to make something look good on telly. We had black box recorders recording, you know, millisecond by millisecond, the forces on each of those cars. We had, as you say, we had over 90 cameras covering the crash from every which way. We had so much data pulled from those crashes. I mean, too much for us to start picking through in a television program, but all of that data and all of those cars have now gone back to this Advanced Vehicle Engineering Center at Cranfield University, run by Professor James Brighton, who was the sort of mastermind behind the setup of the crash. And all of that data is now being used to inform the next generation of engineers and designers. So that is all happening now. But the experiment needed to be immersive, and it was. We had a psychologist studying the drivers and seeing how immersed they were in that experience, and very much they were. And what we found was that more experienced drivers were able to see what was happening earlier on in the process. And in fact, we had one driver who managed to pretty much be able to drive away after the event. Such was his forethought and the way he was able to manage his car on that surface. We had another driver who was very young, very inexperienced, only because she had only recently passed her test. And her response was, I mean, panic is harsh. It was a high-stress situation, and she didn't know where she was, what she was doing, how to get out of it. And although she managed to stop safely, she then just wanted to get out of that space, and in doing so, actually ended up under the truck. There are so many variables in this experiment, and that's why something like this can never replace those lab tests. But what it did was throw real-world randomness into an experimental setup. And just picking through that has been fascinating for everyone involved.
Tom Adams is executive producer of the new PBS documentary, Ultimate Crash Test. It comes to us from our colleagues at Nova and is available to stream on YouTube. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Two long-running conflicts on the continent of Africa are facing very different prospects right now. In Congo, a war between the state and the M23 rebels, backed by Rwanda, may be on the verge of a peace settlement. That's according to President Trump.
But in Sudan, the civil war is getting more destructive. And now the U.S. is accusing the Sudanese army of using chemical weapons. Both of these conflicts are top priorities for Ambassador Troy Fittrell. He's the senior official leading the State Department's Africa Bureau. We spoke earlier today, and I asked him about the potential for a peace agreement in Congo.
There's a lot of back-channel diplomacy happening at once, but we're optimistic. And I think, frankly, when you address an issue like this, you have to be. You just wouldn't get anywhere with pessimism or cynicism. The DRC and Rwanda have agreed on a statement of principles. We're hoping to get agreement on the text of a peace deal, and that we can put that into place and implement it. And implementing an agreement is always the hardest part. Sometime in the next couple months. And that's an incredibly ambitious timeline. But we don't believe in dragging our heels on this. Action needs to happen right now.
You mentioned a lot of back channels. How have U.S. officials been able to bring these two sides together?
The first and most important part was both sides asked us to be involved. Both sides saw us as a potential broker who could work honestly with both sides and help achieve an agreement.
I understand that the government in Congo is offering the U.S. access to minerals as part of the peace agreement with M23. How is that going to work? What is that going to look like?
Traditionally, we talk about the benefits of peace are that thereafter you could have an economic growth. And we're taking a slightly different approach this time. Having a forward-leaning economic growth intention within the peace process to make sure that there is an obvious benefit to all the participants involved. This is something that's actually quite new and certainly not something I've come across in my career before. And by addressing it in these terms, we end up with a bit more stability, a bit more at stake for everyone who's involved.
I want to turn now to the civil war in Sudan. Yesterday, the U.S. sanctioned Sudan because it says the army has been using chemical weapons. Can you tell us what kind of weapons have been used and what evidence the U.S. government has of that?
Yeah, I don't want to get into those kinds of details, but just that there is some reliable evidence that we have analyzed that substantiates the allegations that have been understood for quite some time. And, I mentioned a few seconds ago how I'd like to be optimistic and that we need to be optimistic in order to achieve anything. I can tell you the Sudan situation challenges that mindset. So trying to work on what is one of the worst humanitarian situations in the world, the ongoing aspect of strategic neutrality, it doesn't seem to be working. And so we think it's absolutely critical to get more directly involved and to get all the individual parties, relevant parties involved. This is not just an African problem. There are plenty of outside actors involved, and the need to make sure that we can address them all really matters.
One of those relevant actors in the conflict that you talked about is the United Arab Emirates, which has been providing weapons to the paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan. That violates the UN arms embargo. If the UAE is part of the problem in Sudan, how is the U.S. trying to find a solution there to put pressure on the UAE?
I'd be careful with accepting all those premises up front and thus leading to a logical conclusion. But I can say that our relationship with the UAE is deep and complex. And there are a number of ways in which we can engage and maintain our relations with them while also looking for a positive cooperative path on Sudan. And it's not just, of course, them. There are a number of other players in the mix as well. I don't want to prejudice the backroom kinds of diplomacy that's going on right now, but we're actively engaged with all of these interested parties.
Are you saying it is not clear to you that the UAE has been providing weapons to the RSF?
I'm saying it's a question that needs to be discussed and probably best discussed discreetly.
I want to switch topics again here. Yesterday on Thursday, President Trump said in a social media post that a group of migrants from different countries, including Cuba, Mexico, and Vietnam, were being sent to South Sudan, but they were apparently stuck en route in the East African nation of Djibouti. What can you tell us about that?
I don't believe we have anyone of that sort in Djibouti. And for access to South Sudan, I would refer you to the government of South Sudan.
That's Ambassador Troy Fittrell. He is the senior official leading the State Department's Africa Bureau. You can listen to an extended version of our conversation online at theworld.org.
Weeks later, it is still unknown what caused a countrywide blackout in Spain on April 30th. On that day, all the lights went out, even traffic lights. It was chaos, as you'd imagine. And now scientists, politicians, and energy executives are still arguing about what happened. But one tiny Spanish village, San Vicente del Monte, was spared from the blackout. The World's Jerry Haddon has the story.
At about 12:30 p.m. on the day Spain went dark, the 197 residents of San Vicente del Monte in Spain's north noticed flickering lights. But it only lasted about 5 seconds, one unidentified resident told a local TV station the next day. Getting to town and finding all the lights on, said another resident, I was just in shock. The power was out everywhere except for here. The power stayed on in San Vicente because of a lithium battery about the size of a file cabinet in a green metal container. It had just been sitting there outside, nearly forgotten on the edge of the village, for 4 years. Mayor Lorenzo González recalls how a local energy company called Viesco showed up in 2021 looking for someone to give it a try.
Y me dicen, oye, que queríamos sacarlo adelante, pero somos incapaces, que no nos dejan colocarlo en ningún sitio.
They said, look, we've been asking all over to set up this experimental battery, but no one's game. I told them, look, if you paint the container thing green so it blends in with the trees, then no problem. That could be the battery's nickname, no problem, because during the blackout, the village had none. The battery was supposed to last for 3 to 4 hours, said that first unnamed resident on TV. But the blackout lasted more than 7 hours, he said, and we never lost juice. All eyes have been on the village since, and not just for being the only place in Iberia for 7 long hours where you could charge your smartphone. Turns out that the little battery that could be part of a plan to avoid another energy catastrophe. But before the possible fixes, first, what went wrong?
Muy probablemente, en la red había demasiada energía.
Spanish scientist and energy grid expert Antonio Turiel says there was most likely too much energy in the grid, which can set sparks flying if not addressed. Pinpointing exactly where the breakdown began will probably take months. In the meantime, the question of why the problem wasn't contained, why the whole country lost power, is causing heated debate, a lot of it zeroing in on renewable energy.
En ese momento tienes un 53% de generación fotovoltaica.
Turiel says that when the blackout hit, renewables, that is, solar and wind, were producing nearly two-thirds of Spain's electricity. When everything's working, explains Turiel, when the grid's in sync and supply and demand are perfectly matched, then renewables are wonderful. But if something unexpected happens, say a windstorm causes a spike in energy production,
mientras había pocos sistemas volcando electricidad a la red, no pasaba nada porque el resto de sistemas sí que tenían capacidad de flexibilidad.
If renewables are just a small part of the energy puzzle, says Turiel, then the traditional systems can adapt and absorb fluctuations. The problem is when renewables are producing the lion's share of electricity and then something goes wrong. That's because renewables can't adapt as quickly as traditional energy sources like gas or hydropower. And since the big blackout on April 30th, that's been getting a lot of attention. But Turiel says beating up on renewables is unfair. Scientists have been warning the European Union for years, he says. You can't just roll out renewable energy without also creating a system to keep it stable.
Tienes una legislación europea que por tal de favorecer una rápida expansión de los sistemas renovables.
We've got these European directives to expand renewables fast, he says. So the EU made lax rules around safety systems. He's talking about systems like maybe a whole network of batteries like the one in San Vicente del Monte. Linked together, they could quickly absorb excess energy or release it during shortfalls. The reason the EU hasn't made this part of the green energy push?
Si tú pones todos los sistemas de estabilización, ya no es en absoluto, ni de lejos.
Because our cheap renewables would end up costing more than gas or coal, says Turiel, once you add in all the necessary infrastructure. For now, no one's willing to pay for it, at least not on a large scale.
Sí, nosotros si Viesgo quiere colocarla, le dejo colocarlas en todos los municipios, en todos los pedanías.
San Vicente Mayor Lorenzo González told local TV recently he'd happily sign off on thousands of batteries set up all across his region in Spain's north. Then again, he got his battery for free. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
In Bangladesh today, the leader of the interim government is threatening to resign. According to news reports, Muhammad Yunus is telling feuding political parties to work out their differences or he will quit.
Yunus, the 84-year-old Nobel Prize-winning economist, stepped in to lead Bangladesh after last year's student-led uprising toppled longtime authoritarian ruler Sheikh Hasina. Zafar Subban is the editor of Counterpoint, a Bangladeshi news site, and he's in the capital, Dhaka.
Let me back up a little and explain the current situation in Bangladesh. So, as you had mentioned, this interim government has been in power since August 8th after the previous dictatorial government was overthrown. And what we have is a really uneasy coalition ruling Bangladesh. So Professor Yunus is the chief advisor, he's the head of the government, but he has a very fractious coalition, both inside government officially and outside, that he presides over. So he has his interim government and their factions within that. You have the BNP, which is the principal opposition party. You have other political parties, including one which has been formed recently by many of the students who are active in the movement to topple the ousted dictator last August. And of course, you have the army.
So is there a sense that Muhammad Yunus is frustrated that he can't move forward or get anything done? What seems to be the tension?
The real issue at play here is elections. You know, how long will we wait? It's been about 10 months since the government was overthrown, the authoritarian government. And there are certain parties, especially the main opposition BNP, who would like to see elections by the end of this year. There are other parties who would like an extended period of time. So I actually really see this as Professor Yunus trying to play the role of the honest broker, saying, look, I don't have a dog in this fight. I would like to see all of the parties with differences come together and come to a compromise in the interests of the nation. And so I think really his threat to resign should be taken in that context. And I think that's really what it is. I don't actually see him resigning.
You mentioned the military, and the military has had a kind of interesting role in this whole thing, their behavior during the student-led protests and afterwards in terms of dealing with the deposed leader, Sheikh Hasina. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to American ears, it might sound unusual because, of course, in countries in the West, one doesn't really expect the military to play such an active political role. But in our part of the world, it's very common. And in fact, the military played a very positive role near the end of Hasina's rule because, of course, she called out the military in aid of her government to try and quell and quash the protests. And they took the very bold step of refusing to move against the student leaders, against the people of Bangladesh. And since then, of course, they are part of an informal ruling coalition. So they are a player and they do have an interest in this. And I think that's something most people in Bangladesh not only recognize, I don't think too many people in Bangladesh have a great deal of a problem with it.
So what has to happen to bring these parties together to hammer this out about when elections are going to be held?
I think it's really kind of coalescing around December as really the outer limit of when we want to see elections. They're really drawing a line then and saying, we really need to see action on this. We've discussed this over the last 10 months. We've gone back and forth, but there hasn't really been any commitment made. So let's get a commitment. Let's all get on the same page and ensure that there's no backsliding.
Zafar Subban is the editor of a news site called Counterpoint in Dhaka, Bangladesh.
Russia and Ukraine got started today with the largest prisoner swap yet. Nearly 400 soldiers and civilians from each side were exchanged, and more are expected to follow over the weekend. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the agreement would include a total of 1,000 prisoners each. So far, this is the most tangible outcome of peace talks between the two countries. Charles Kupchin is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served on the staff of the National Security Council during the Obama and Clinton administrations and joined us from Washington.
The good news is that it is the biggest swap to date, about 1,000 prisoners on both sides. And the other piece of news that's generally upbeat is that this was the product of the first face-to-face negotiations between Ukrainians and Russians since early on in the war. And so at least the two sides are talking. But I would say that the glass is more half empty than half full. And that's because the discussions that took place in Turkey did so at a low level, even though Zelensky and Trump said they were ready to go and meet Putin. And secondly, there's no sign that this swap is the beginning of the end of the war.
Okay.
Putin still has basically maximalist war aims that suggest that he is not ready to call it quits.
So this is kind of the one concrete measure, as you said, that came out of those in-person negotiations. What are the biggest stumbling blocks to making any more progress on a ceasefire? You mentioned, of course, Putin's maximalist aims.
Well, I would say that the Kremlin continues to talk about getting at what it calls the root causes of the conflict. And I think that means two things in Putin's mind. One is what he calls the denazification and demilitarization of Ukraine, which essentially means regime change, essentially means pulling the 80% of Ukraine that is still free back into Russia's sphere of influence. And the other is he wants to roll back the post-Cold War order to get NATO to move forces back from the eastern flank. Those are non-starters, right? We're not going to see the Ukrainians agree to any deal that doesn't leave them sovereign and secure in what's left of Ukraine.
1,000 prisoners on each side, though, as you said, is the biggest prisoner swap so far. Even if we can't read too much into it, what allowed that to happen, this largest prisoner swap ever?
Well, you know, I think you have to give the Trump administration credit for trying. It was good that Trump reached out and called Putin. He's spoken to him three times. Trump has sent his top aides to meet Russians in Saudi Arabia. This U.S.-Russian dialogue has to happen, in part because one way to get Putin to say yes is to hold out the prospect of normalization of relations between the United States and Russia.
Is there anything that you might see and say, oh, maybe this is the beginning of the end?
I think right now the key issue is what are Trump's next moves? Because I do think he's getting frustrated with Putin. I do think he expected that Putin would be easier to deal with, that he had a relationship with Putin that he could cash in on. And if Trump comes to the conclusion that Putin is playing him, I think Trump will probably double down. He does not want to go down in history as the American president who lost Ukraine.
Charles Kupchin is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stay with us for more here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. A towering figure in the world of Russian ballet has died. Yuri Grigorovich was the artistic director of the Bolshoi Ballet from 1964 until 1995. He was one of the most important choreographers of the Soviet era and one of the most controversial ones. Grigorovich passed away this week at the age of 98. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
There is a stereotype of the strict Russian ballet teacher screaming things at his students like, "You are all horrible!" That, more or less, was Yuri Grigorovich. He ruled the Bolshoi Ballet for three decades, at times with an iron fist. His prima ballerina, the superstar Maya Plesetskaya, called him Little Stalin.
He ran the Bolshoi Theater like a dictatorship.
Simon Morrison is a professor of music at Princeton University and author of Bolshoi Confidential.
He'd bark at the dancers with cognac in hand. You think you know what you're doing? You don't. I know. You know, and it was this demanding, impatient. He was just really tough on them.
And yet he was also admired as a choreographer and a tough operator who knew how to work the state. As he said in an interview on his 85th birthday, I've been called an innovator, a conservative, an egomaniac. I've been called everything. Yuri Nikolaevich Grigorovich was born in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, in 1927, 10 years after the Russian Revolution. He had his ballet debut as a 10-year-old in The Nutcracker and went on to dance as a soloist with the Kirov Ballet before turning to choreography. He was tapped to run the Bolshoi in 1964. Grigorovich summed up his artistic vision in a 1986 BBC documentary.
All forms of ballet are good, as Molière said, except the boring.
Boring he was not. Grigorovich's most famous ballet is Spartacus, to music by Aram Khachaturian. It was a work conceived for the 50th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Spartacus is an allegory, the story of a slave revolt against the Romans that's supposed to stand for the revolt of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie. The movements are hyper-energized, big, acrobatic. This developed into Grigorovich's signature style, says author Simon Morrison, characterized by
incredibly simplified storytelling, good guys, bad guys, plot, just straightforward, very angular.
And then he replaced the emotional subtleties and nuances of traditional ballet with this incredible kinetic energy.
He had dancers performing things that really looked dangerous on stage, like just stretched them to the limits. So it was this kind of superhuman virtuosity that he was after.
That and showcasing men.
It's all men, basically, except when he was creating roles for his wife. But these works are very male, very alpha.
Very Soviet. The Bolshoi, in part because of Cold War cultural competition, was sent out in the late 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s on tour to Europe and the U.S.
At New York's Metropolitan Opera House, crowds wait around the clock to see Moscow's Bolshoi Ballet. And it's hard to tell capitalists from proletariat. The first-nighters include more people who don't bother to dress up than people who do.
The company would perform Spartacus, or versions of Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty that Grigorovich had pared down and supercharged with athleticism. That annoyed the ballet Cognoscenti, but international crowds ate it up, says Morrison. It was nothing like any ballet they'd ever seen.
The reason why people loved seeing the Bolshoi, even when the costumes started to look kind of shabby, was that they were telling stories, right? And in the West, we had moved away from storytelling towards, you know, abstraction and formalism and the Balanchine plotless ballet thing. And suddenly you could go to a show and see these dancers who were like dancing their hearts out.
Yuri Grigorovich was the most influential figure in Russian ballet through the 60s. But then his reputation began to slip. His last original work was in 1982. Critics said the Bolshoi was in artistic decline. Top talent fled to the West. They said Grigorovich was the reason why. He was finally forced to resign in 1995. But even then, the night after his resignation, a group of dancers and stagehands went on strike.
Grigorovich is a genius.
Grigorovich is a genius, one dancer told reporters. That night's performance of Romeo and Juliet was canceled. The first time the show did not go on in the Bolshoi's 200-year history. Today, Grigorovich's ballets are back in the Bolshoi repertoire in full force. And he was asked back to the Bolshoi in 2008 as ballet master. Insiders say his grip on Russia's most famous stage remained powerful until his death. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Imagine waking up one morning to find a huge container ship sitting right next to your little house. This is Johan Helberg, who lives in Norway, about a six-hour drive north of Oslo, telling the story to Norway's national broadcaster. The giant ship ran aground about 20 feet from his bedroom.
And here's the best part. Helberg had no idea the ship was there. He was fast asleep until a frantic neighbor rang his doorbell and then called him repeatedly.
Hørte ingenting.
I didn't hear a thing, Helberg said. I was told there was a loud noise, but it must have been a slow rumbling and not a bang. It was, in fact, a slow rumbling, as video of the ship running aground shows.
Police say the operator on the ship probably fell asleep. A tugboat attempted to remove the ship from Johan Helberg's yard yesterday, but it has not been able to pull it back into the water.
It's likely you won't recognize his name, but there's a good chance, if you've been listening to our show over the years, that you've heard some of the music that he helped spread around the world.
What shall we do?
I was a Latin American studies major, and I decided after I graduated to visit the countries I'd studied. I took a trip down to Colombia, saw a little museum, that had a number of crafts in it from the Putumayo area, and I was interested in handicrafts, and I decided to start a business importing them.
Dan Storper, founder, creator, and president of Putumayo World Music, died yesterday at age 74. He spent his life collecting music from the many places he visited. He was a marketing wonder, selling his company's CDs in Starbucks, Whole Foods, and other unlikely stores.
Dan Storper helped bring artists like Zimbabwean musician Oliver Mutukudzi to the international stage. Storper was also a guest on our program. Our colleague Marco Werman will have a remembrance of Dan Storper next week.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.